Hey, dude. Have you tried Hey Dude? Hey Dude shoes have an ultra lightweight design and velvety softness that feels like floating on clouds. They slip on so easily, you'll want them every time you leave the house. And just like your phone and your keys, you might occasionally check you're even still wearing them. They're so comfy. Hey Dude shoes. Shoes so comfortable, you'll say, dude. Step into effortless style and try a pair at heydudeshoes.com.
Welcome to Looking at Lucasfilm with Brian Gunn, the podcast with a different perspective on the worlds of Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and all of the other entities that George Lucas, Kathleen Kennedy, Dave Filoni, and Jon Favreau, as well as the rest of the team at Lucasfilm, have dreamed up over the past 43 years. By the way, Brian, wow. Just check today, according to the official Lucasfilm Limited webpage, Lucasfilm was, and I'm quoting directly from that website now, born out of necessity in 1971 on the heels of George's feature film debut, which, of course, was THX 1138. There we go.
So that was made, so Lucasfilm became around or at the same time as The Godfather was being made?
Pretty much. Okay. But the official release date for THX 1138 is March 11th, 1971. So should we now consider this the official founding day of Lucasfilm Limited?
Well, founding day is fine, but we still have what's the real Star Wars day? I mean, you know, Lucasfilm is the father of all things, but still, how many Star Wars fans have really seen THX 1138?
Interesting question. Okay, so I guess what we're asking is if somebody from Kathleen Kennedy's office or up at the Presidio wants to get back to us with the official word on this. I mean, again, we don't want to give Looking at Lucasfilm listeners bad info, no. But all right.
Not at all.
Well, speaking of we, I am entertainer writer Jim Hill, and my co-host, pop culture enthusiast Brian Gunn, and I are recording this week's show on Tuesday, August 27, 2024, which is just 6 days out from Labor Day, which this year, by the way, is being observed on Monday, September 2nd. So where did the summer go, Brian?
Where is the year going? Do you believe it's already almost, I mean, around the corner is Halloween and then Thanksgiving and Christmas. I mean, it's been an incredibly quick year.
Speaking of which, I forget who it was in the retail sphere was complaining, as I do. I go to Target and, you know, and I want to say that the Halloween decorations went up right after the 4th of July. And I was complaining to one of my friends there, and they basically said, you are now familiar with the concept of Augtober and A-U-G-T-O-B-E-R, with the notion that Halloween actually, as far as the retail space is concerned, Halloween now begins in October and then runs till the second week of November. So
yes, they also call that Summerween too.
Summerween also.
Yeah, I've heard that because out here there are several conventions that do a Halloween in August. There's one at Pasadena.
That's
where
right.
They actually have haunted houses. It's called
Screaming in the Dark. Yes, yes, yeah. Yes.
And they're big ones in Long Beach, but they're midsummer ones in Midsummer Scream, they call it, is in Pasadena. It's very cool.
Yeah, but they do all sorts of cool panels, you know, talk about the history of the Haunted Mansion, that sort of thing. So, well, anyway, getting back to where the summer went, we know where at least 3 days this summer went, and that was to the D23 Expo, which was held at the Anaheim Convention Center and the Honda Center on August 11th, 9th through the 11th, and Brian and I spent three filled days wandering the halls there, and we're going to talk at length about the Lucasfilm-related stuff we saw and experienced at the D23 Expo in a moment in the news segment of today's show, which reminds me, I need to mention that the news portion of today's show is brought to you by touringplans.com, and if you're headed back down to the City Beautiful anytime soon to experience one of the theme parks that can be found in and around Orlando. Well, touring plans can not only help you save time, it can also help you save money as you wander around Walt Disney World or the parks to be found over at the Universal Orlando Resort. So please check them out at touringplans.com. Okay, Brian.
Yes.
I'm going to turn to you now. And what was your favorite Lucasfilm-related thing that you saw or experienced at this year's Expo?
Well, the main thing was at Disney Plus, mm-hmm. where they had a mannequins, I guess you would, or they had characters mm-hmm. from Skeleton Crew.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was really cool. Mm-hmm. But what's really strange, the first day, and I took pictures of it, and I have it because I sent it to Devin. They had the robot that, of course, had a peg leg and a patch over its eye. So, you know, maybe it's One-Eyed Willie or something connected. But anyway, the robot was gone the next day. They had four characters, one that looked like a werewolf, mm-hmm. and then two pirate characters that looked right out of Mandalorian. But the main thing was, They had this robot that looked like it was all beat up and that you saw in the preview also, but it disappeared. And it was weird because it didn't look like it was ever there. They made it look like it was never there. So that was strange. But I got pictures. I'll put them on my Instagram everybody can see it. So, and that was the main thing. I mean, there wasn't a lot on the floor, but okay. They had the ILM.
I was about to say, the volume demo was pretty impressive. I mean,
if you could get in to see it.
Well, yes. All right. And that actually, circling back to my co-host on Disney Dish, Len Testa, in a recent interview that he did with the Wall Street Journal, came up with a term that sort of captures the moment. Len was talking about Disney complexity fatigue and how it's impacting people on their vacations to Walt Disney World when they're getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning to try to get Lightning Lane reservations or that sort of thing. What was interesting is that I experienced this personally at the D23 Expo because in order, for example, to get in the virtual queue for the Disney D23 store up on the second floor of the Anaheim Convention Center, my good friend Angela Ragno literally set an alarm for 4 o'clock in the morning because that's when the queue opened up. And even then, even getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, she got skunked. And I bring this up because it was kind of the same thing with the volume. In fact, I'm kind of embarrassed because at one point early in the show, I literally walked in and was enjoying a presentation and then stepped out to meet with friends, only to then be informed I had somehow circumvented the system. And, oh, no, you can't go in that way. You have to get on the app. You have to use the QRL code and get a reservation. And if you don't have a reservation, please stand in our standby line. And it became almost impossible to get into. Now, mind you, it was huge enough and big enough and that sort of thing that you could observe. And it was amazing.
Yeah, I did see it from the back and the side, and I stood there until they told me to move along. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was really, you could not tell. Mm-hmm. It looked like the background was real. But there was a lot of things like that I don't think they needed a line. I don't think if they just had the show going every 20 minutes or so, people would have filed in, people would have filed out. That's what happened over at the theater.
Okay.
Yeah, people came up. If there was too many people, they came back the next show. And especially like at the last day in the Imagineering when they opened up the two rooms and I think they artificially made the line long because you go in there and there was really nothing to see that you didn't see online.
We will get to what Imagineering is up to on the second half of today's show. But circling back to Star Wars things, kind of ironic, what seemed to be the hottest toy or collectible at this year's D23 was actually a full, well, not full scale, I want to say it was like 18 inches long and a foot wide, a replica of the Star Speeder 3000, the original Star Tours ride vehicle, and only 3,000 of these things were reportedly made. And what was cool about it is you could take it out of the box, pull off the roof, and look inside the 40 seats in the six different rows. But what was cool is that on an LED screen at the front, they played the entire original Star Tours film. And a lovely, only a nerd would appreciate this detail. They would run it in six different segments that keyed off of when the cuts in the ride film.
Oh, cool. And there was a Rex in it?
There was a Rex.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, I didn't see that. Do you know anybody who got one?
Well, my buddy Drew Taylor actually got one. In fact, he was making the joke to the effect that as he was schlepping it around the show that this is the initial piece of decoration for his bachelor department after Katie divorces him for bringing home one too many pieces of crap from a Disney collectible show.
Do you know how much it was?
It was $300.
Oh, that's not bad at all.
Well, but what's interesting is, of course, if you go over to eBay, you plan on spending multiples right. to get that. And what was interesting is that they did not go clean at the expo. In fact, as I understand it, the Monday after the expo, there were a handful of these things that turned up at the World of Disney in Anaheim, but I guess they were gone that morning.
Wow.
Word got out and people came and grabbed them. Anyway, now, a moment ago, Brian referred to the Star Wars Skeleton Crew photo op that was found in the Disney Plus area there on the show floor. And we also got on Friday night as part of the Disney Studios presentation at the Honda Center, we got a trailer for Star Wars Skeleton Crew, which seems to be set in the Star Wars equivalent of suburbia. And this is
the planet of suburbia. That's pretty cool.
There we go. Well, I mean, if you think about it, if it stands to reason,
a middle class planet.
Yeah. Well, what is the city planet that the Jedi Temple is on?
Corsican?
Yeah, well, I mean, if this Corsican, there's got to be a planet suburbia.
Exactly. Maybe it's just a moon or something. Just okay. Like where the Costco is, the space Costco.
There we go. Where this log line for this new limited series for Disney Plus, which, by the way, debuts on December 3rd, is that four children end up on an adventure and trying to make their way home after being lost in the galaxy following a discovery that they make on their home planet. Now, what was kind of interesting about this was a number of folks, when they saw this trailer, said, ooh, that reminds me of Goonies, where you, Brian, made, I think, a more appropriate reference. In fact, no, that this isn't Goonies. This is Explorers. And
yeah, Joe Dante's Explorers.
Yeah, from 1985. And that is a fascinating time when it comes to fantasy films, or excuse me, sci-fi fantasy films.
Right.
Because you have to remember, 3 years previous, we had E.T. released June 11th, 1982. 83, we had the third Star Wars movie, Return of the Jedi. That came out May 25th, 1983. And then in June of 84, we got Joe Dante's Gremlins, which I would argue is more of a comedy horror movie.
Oh, and a Christmas movie. You got to call it a Christmas movie.
Okay. But anyway, long story short, the lesson that Hollywood took away from those three films doing that well in that window of time is a kid-friendly sci-fi movie that opens in early summer will make bank. So the very next summer, inside of 1 5-week-long period, we got Goonies from Warner Brothers. That came out June 7th, 1985, had a $19 million budget, did very well at the box office, made $125 million worldwide. Back to the Future comes out from Universal. That arrives on July 3rd, 1985. Same thing, had a $19 million budget. That one makes $388 million worldwide and spawns two sequels, theme park rides, and the like. Then there's Explorers. That comes from Paramount. That gets released to theaters on July 12th, 1985. It had a $20 million budget. But what's fascinating is it went in the exact opposite direction of Goonies and Back to the Future. It actually only made $9.9 million domestically. And,
yeah.
And now what's kind of interesting about this is Joe Dante, in fact, they did an anniversary screening of this a while back. And Dante spoke prior to the screening, explained, well, look, I was just coming off of Gremlins. And for the first time in my career, I was hot. And Paramount reached out and said they had this script called Explorers. And he read it and he said, it doesn't have a third act. And it's like, right. Don't worry about it. All right, we'll figure out what the
we'll get there.
third act is while we're making this. But we need
it will
this.
Come to us.
There we go. But we need this for the summer of 85. That we need this for next summer. So we need to get started now. And so Dante makes some inspired choices. I mean, Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix, they actually make their screen debut in this movie.
Amazing cast.
And they reach out to ILM, and they're going to handle the effects. And they are literally in the middle of production when suddenly word comes down that not only is then Paramount Pictures chairman and CEO Barry Diller leaving for 20th Century Fox, but in a further sort of earthquake moment at that studio, Michael Eisner bails. He's the president of Paramount at that point, and he goes over to Disney and becomes that company's new chairman and CEO. So, and then as everyone's still trying to get their feet under them, within a month, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's actually in charge of the studio, day to day operations, he leaves for Disney. So, in effect, every decision maker at the studio walked out the door while Joe was making this movie. And again, remember, they're the ones said, we'll fix it. Well, we'll figure out the ending while we're doing that. And then Dante is in the middle of cutting the movie when he hears that Paramount has decided that they're going to move up the release date from August to the second week of July. And effectively, they take the movie away from him before he's finished editing it. And they were like, oh, this will be a hit all by itself. And of course, that's...
Did they see it?
Well, that's the thing. I remember seeing
I hate saying that. I loved the movie. The ending had nothing to do with the movie, mm-hmm. but I loved it. And if I would have seen the ending on its own, I would have dug it 100% because it was hilarious. It was great. It just didn't make any kind of sense to what those kids were going through to get there. And then it's like, oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, for me, the weird thing is when I see the ending of Explorers, it feels to me like this was left over from Amazing Stories. Just
yes.
Kind of had that Spielberg gag ending feel to it.
But it's funny how Spielberg, this was the only one of those films that you mentioned that wasn't mm-hmm. a Spielberg film.
Yeah.
And that's probably what hurt it, because I'm guarantee you Steven would have went in there and goes, oh, this is what you need to do. Because he has his pulse on these kinds of things.
Well, and what's interesting is Brian and I were pre-gaming the show tonight. Brian began asking me about Flight of the Navigator, which
right.
What's kind of interesting about Flight of the Navigator is it comes out the summer after all this. It's out, arrives in theaters July 30th, 1986. So it's one of the very first things that Eisner greenlights as he comes through the door. So it's this fascinating moment of, hey, I couldn't finish making that movie while I was at Paramount, but let's make something similar to that here at Disney. And of course, anybody who knows their Star Wars history understands that Paul Reubens is the voice of the intelligence that flies the spaceship in Flight of the Navigator. And it was actually his work on that movie that got him the role of Rex on Star Tours. And of course, Randall Kleiser, who directed this movie, then went on to direct a number of theme park related ride films. I mean, things like Honey, I Shrunk the Audience for Disney. I mean, right. He was all in that space.
No, Randall Kleiser is one of those directors that not a lot of people would know if you'd say his name, mm-hmm. but you mention his films and you're going, oh, yeah, that's on my top 10. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he's like one of those stealth directors. I mean, he directed Grease, right?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, so.
In fact, what was it? Kevin Smith just recently posted a vlog where he was talking about how he was at the screening for, I want to say it was the opening day screening for Deadpool and Wolverine. And Randall Kleiser came up and introduced himself in the lobby. Of course, Kevin knew his filmography, and in the middle of Deadpool and Wolverine, there's an action scene that's actually staged to "You're the One That I Want," and Kevin literally he's in the same row as Randall and leans down and out in the lobby. It's like, you made this movie 30 years ago and it still resonates. How cool is that? So, all right. Oh, before I forget. We were just talking Flight of the Navigator. There were plans announced to do a remake of this back in September of 2021. But what was interesting, it was Bryce Dallas Howard, who on the back of her very successful episodes of The Mandalorian was given the opportunity to direct this.
Cool.
And it's supposedly going to be built around a female protagonist. And haven't heard about this one in a while. And speaking of Mandalorian, also at the studio presentation in the Honda Center, Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni stood on stage and shared footage from Mando and Grogu. We are a while away from seeing this film in theaters, folks. The release date is May 22nd, 2026. And more to the point, they had only been shooting for 2 weeks. But both Favreau and Filoni were like, if we don't bring footage to this, people will hurt us.
Right.
So they showed that footage. And what was especially interesting the very next night during the studios, the Disney Experiences presentation, which is when Disney Parks, Cruise Line, that sort of thing.
Right.
They revealed that while Mando and Grogu is being shot, they're also prepping a brand new ride film for
Smuggler's Run.
Yeah, Millennium Falcon Smuggler's Run that will be built around Mando and Grogu.
Now, they just said it was a ride film. I mean, we'll still have Hondo in there probably, right? And he'll just say, I've got this new guy who's going to go into space with you or something like that.
I believe so. What I've also been hearing is that this next generation version of the film, the Millennium Falcon Smuggler's Run film, they're dropping the interactive element. It's evident it's the least popular aspect of this attraction. So they're going to lean into a genuine experience with Grogu and Mando. So let's see how that plays out.
So will they have probably more seats in there then? Or
I don't think they can. That's a part of the omelet they got to live with.
Okay. Which is not bad. I mean, but like I said, the second time I was on it was with Devin, and he just like a champ, he took over. But I can see that. It's better to sit back and enjoy what's going on than having to have a play experience. But I'm going to miss something like that, though.
Well, it's I mean, this is what I've been told. Now, mind you, if in the Mando and Grogu film there is an action scene that lends itself to, we need your help to
push this button. Oh, that would be cool. Yeah.
But I think the whole, I need your help to steal coaxium thing.
Yeah, yeah.
They're going to go with a much simpler, easier to follow story.
Oh, I have to tell you about Star Tours. I went on Star Tours again the day before the D23, and I saw Andor.
Oh, okay.
He's now in the show. He's the one. Yeah, it's The first one I saw was Mando. You get a message from space, and it's Mando and Grogu. Mm-hmm. Then the second one I saw was Ahsoka, and now they have an Andor one.
Okay.
Now, did you know there was going to be an Andor one? Because I didn't. I was surprised.
Well, they were supposedly when this particular ride film was proposed. Again, they were leaning into the popular D23 properties. So yes, that's Ahsoka, that's Andor, and that's Mando.
Now I have one more thing to say. I'm sorry. On Star Tours, when Ahsoka's in there, at the beginning of the ride, when you go out of the spaceship and you go into hyperspace, I swear to God, Ahsoka's ship is there. And she goes off to hyperspace first, and then we go to hyperspace, like to follow her. And I only saw that once, and I'm trying to see it again, but I haven't seen the Ahsoka thing. So maybe I saw something, maybe I didn't.
Okay. Now, interesting you mention Andor, because we've learned just recently the last day of production on season 2 of that show was February 9th of this year. And according to the production team, it's going to take them the better part of a year to do post. So we're looking for season 2 of that to debut on Disney Plus in the first quarter of next year, 2025.
Oh, wow.
On the other hand, season 2 of The Acolyte is now...
It's coming when? When is it coming?
Not happening. Look, folks, we talked about this at length on a recent Looking at Lucasfilm.
Right.
That show got too dark, and what was interesting is that to hear folks at that subscription streaming service talk, the audience fell off. They walked away in droves with the latter episodes. In fact, I was told that Acolyte viewership collapsed following the first two episodes. People sampled it and were like, yeah, no. Whereas Andor, on the other hand, viewership steadily climbed over the course of the first season, which is why a second season got picked up. Andor also got exceptional reviews, whereas Acolytes were more mixed. Another thing that evidently was factored into this is that the budget for Acolyte was $180 million, which translates to $630,000 a minute. Which is a trifle expensive. Now, mind you, this could have gone another way. Jeff Schneider, in his always entertaining Inside the Industry newsletter, was talking about how very early on in this production, they went after Keanu Reeves to play the role of Master Soul. Which ended up being played in the final production by Lee Zhangjie.
Right.
And evidently Reeves was genuinely intrigued by this idea because it meant that he was then going to be sharing a lot of screen time with his old Matrix co-star, Carrie-Anne Moss. But where this fell apart was that he had committed to filming the John Wick spinoff, Ballerina.
Okay.
And he had what they describe as a key supporting role in that project, and Lionsgate just refused to adjust their schedule on Ballerina to allow him to go off and do Acolyte. And you got to wonder, would this have been a different story with Keanu Reeves' star power in that role? Would people have hung in there? Would they have had a different take on this story?
Yeah, they might have hung in there just to see where it was going. I don't think that it would have been a different story that much because the character is there was a lot of problems about it. But the thing about canceling it, they finally gave us something of another part of Star Wars that had nothing to do with the Skywalker saga. And we were looking forward to this. I mean, at least I was looking forward to it because we're going back to the Old Republic. We're going to see how the Sith began. We're going to see how Plagueis, came up with his idea to create life. All this was being told to us in this, and now there's nothing. And it says you can't leave us just hanging. Maybe they did it the wrong way.
There's an old cliche that you only get one chance to make a first impression.
I know.
And again, just classic story of George Lucas himself going up and down the Journal of the Wills looking for the story point to bring people into the tale of Star Wars, and that was A New Hope. And I just feel that with The Acolyte, this was to go with the early days of the Republic, to pick this moment to try to tell that story. It was a bad choice. I mean, there's just no other way to say that.
There was a lot of bad choice, and most of all was that they showed everybody their hand before they even went in there. They had an agenda, and they're going to say what it was going to be, and they just didn't let people with the Andor. You didn't know what the hell was going on. You didn't know what it was about. You didn't know where it was going, and they gave you four mini movies that really expanded the Star Wars universe.
Okay, I would argue that given that anybody who's actually seen Rogue Squadron or Rogue One.
Rogue One. Okay, yes.
You know what happened.
How it ends.
To Cassian Andor. All right. And the fact that this, and that's the other thing that's interesting supposedly about season four, season two. We're going to see the next 4 years of his life and how he becomes the guy we meet at the front of at the start of Rogue One. And I would argue that's a tougher
absolutely
to stick the landing that we know
100%.
So
well, you know what, but they can't let this go. We've already introduced Plagueis, we think. Why don't they just go back and do a Darth Plagueis story? I mean, they can still use some of the characters, but they don't have to use the Acolyte characters.
Don't get me wrong. There is a market for the darker side, for the outlaws in the Star Wars universe. In fact, just this week, on August 30th, we're getting Star Wars Outlaws from Massive Entertainment. It bows on PlayStation 5, the Xbox, and the early reviews. Rolling Stone is calling Outlaws one of the best Star Wars games ever made. So there's definitely appetite out there for these sets of characters, for that sort of storytelling in the Star Wars world. I just don't think Acolyte did this well. Now, mind you, just to circle back to Keanu Reeves for a moment, supposedly, while folks at Lucasfilm were disappointed that he couldn't come on board, the door is open for him to come do other things. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
What if he was Darth Plagueis?
Let it go. Right? On behalf of Anna and Elsa, let it go.
All right.
That's going to do it for the new segment of the show, folks. And coming up, what's in the works for the Indiana Jones themed retheme of Dinosaur the Ride at Animal Kingdom? Also, how Indy actually wound up in the Disney theme parks. But first, this.
Nurses, are you tired of spending weeks or even months finding the perfect job that matches your specialty with your ideal shift and salary? LinkedIn has improved your job search experience. Search by specialty, the shift you want to work, and the salary you want to make. Go to linkedin.com/nurses and begin searching today. That's linkedin.com/nurses.
Note, side effects may include less time finding the perfect job, working a shift that you love with a salary that can take you to St. Thomas, Jamaica, and continuous smiling because of how simple this process was.
BTW, FYI. Visit Nexplanon.com/RN to learn about Nexplanon. It's an adjustable implant, 68 milligrams radio pay. Or ask your HCP IRL. Okay, TTYL.
Looking to invest? Start your journey by exploring exchange-traded funds with GlobalX ETFs. Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs for short, create baskets of stocks, bonds, and other assets that you can buy in a single trade. GlobalX specializes in ETFs that track emerging trends, like the rise of artificial intelligence, as well as strategies aimed to generate income potential. Visit GlobalXETFs.com to discover how you can get started.
And we're back. And speaking of back, let's get back to this year's D23 Expo. Now, As we learned, there's a proposed redo of Dinerland USA for Disney's Animal Kingdom. This was talked about at a Destination D in 2023. And at this year's D23 Expo, Josh D'Amaro confirmed that this is a go project.
Right. It was Blue Sky in 23, and now it's a, or 22, and now it's a go.
Yeah, it's a shovel-ready project. So Dinorama is being changed into an Encanto-themed area, while the Dino Institute, currently home to Dinosaur the Ride, will be reimagined as a Mayan-inspired version of the Indiana Jones adventure that's found at both Disneyland in Anaheim and likewise Tokyo Disney Seas. Now, Dinorama could close as early as this fall, so site prep can then begin on the Encanto project. Whereas Dinosaur the Ride, current word is that enhanced motion vehicle dark ride will likely remain in operation until after the holidays, with nobody's saying anything about a definite closure date. But right now it's looking like if you enjoy that attraction, best to get there and experience this before January 2025 ends. Just putting that out.
Now, I know that it was based on the same ride system as Indiana Jones, but was it the same layout? Do you know?
That's how it's always been explained to me, which is one of the reasons why supposedly it's relatively easy to put a Indiana Jones adventure into the same ride building. But mind you, again, new story set in the tropical Americas with a sort of a Mayan big bad at the center of the temple. So speaking of this pending redo of Dinosaur the Ride, thought we'd use this as an excuse to talk about how Disney originally got in the Indiana Jones business. And first public inkling that this might actually happen came back in February of 1985. We're spending a lot of time in 1985 on this show. Michael Eisner was presiding over his first ever shareholders meeting. He'd been on the job as Disney CEO, new CEO and chairman for just 5 months at that point. Anyway, big headline coming out of this shareholders meeting, or so says the New York Times, that was Disney Lucasfilm team up. And here's a quote from that article. Walt Disney Productions had reached an agreement with Lucasfilm Limited, the producer of the Star Wars and Indiana Jones feature films, to develop new attractions for Disney's theme park, Disney announced today. Michael Eisner, the former president of Paramount Pictures, was associated there with Lucasfilm's chairman, George Lucas, in the development of box office hits Raiders of the Lost Ark and Indiana Jones Temple of Doom. And in a prepared statement, Mr. Eisner said that the Lucas Company's first project for Disney would be, quoting here, an innovative ride based on his Star Wars creations, and it will utilize technologies never before seen in a Disney theme park. So, okay, Brian, we know that the innovative ride that Eisner's talking about here is Star Tours, with the very first version of that motion-based simulator opening at Disneyland Park back in January, on January 9th, 1987, and you were there. We've told that,
I was there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what's not generally known as well is that Walt Disney Productions and Lucasfilm had been in business together since 1979. That's when Disney licensed the rights to produce a series of children's read-along albums based on the Star Wars movies. And there were 10 of these made, which then went out into stores under Disney's Buena Vista Records label rather than the Disneyland Story teller label, which, because Brian and I are old, we played constantly as children. But okay, now more to the point, George Lucas, who was a lifelong Disney fan, now used this new business arrangement with Walt Disney Productions as a way to get what he wanted from the mouse. Case in point, sound engineer Ben Burtt is working on the runaway mine car scene from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom in 83. And he needs recordings of wheels on ore cars squealing as they go through tight turns. And George is, not to worry, Ben, hang on. He gets on the phone to Ron Miller, who at that point is the chairman and CEO of Walt Disney Productions. And the next thing Ben knows, he's directed to show up at Disneyland's Harbor House Gate at midnight one night. And as the park is closing for the day, and this would have been during the summer months of 83, back when Disneyland would often stay open until 1 o'clock in the morning, and Bert was directed to grab all of his sound recording equipment and follow a Disneyland employee who, over the next 6 or so hours, took Ben backstage at Space Mountain, at the Matterhorn, and at Big Thunder Mountain, anywhere that vehicles traveled on tracks and then squealed and rattled as they humped along rough stretches of track or went around tight turns. And Bert reportedly got hours of great recording, which he then took back up to Skywalker Ranch in Marin County and carefully edited that down to specific sound elements, many of which you can hear today whenever you watch Temple of Doom. And me personally, Brian, it's always cracked me up that as you watch, you know, Indy and Short Round and Willie Scott in their mine car careening, they're repeatedly escaping certain death, but everything or a lot of what you're hearing is actually recorded at the happiest place on earth. So, all right. Anyway, by the way, those phone calls could go both ways. Summer of 1984, Ron Miller calls George Lucas while he's up in residence at Skywalker Ranch, and Ron asks George to make the 90-minute drive over to Napa to Silverado Vineyards, a winery that the Disney family had established at the Stag Leap District a few years earlier in 81. And by the way, the Disney family would go on to operate Silverado Vineyard for more than 4 decades. But with the tragic death of Diane Disney Miller, who passed away at the age of 79 back in November of 2013, due to complications related to a fall, and then with Ron's sad passing in February of 2019, he was 85 at the time.
Wow.
Walt's grandkids decided it was time to hand off the Napa operation to others. So Foley Family Wines purchased Silverado Vineyards from the Disney family back in June of 2022 with the desire to, and I'm quoting from the Silverado website now, continue the time-honored traditions of the Miller family. So that's no longer held by the Disney family. But all right. Anyway, back to 84. Which I'd like to say was a happier time for the Miller family, but to be honest, it wasn't. This is when Green Mailers, Ivan Boesky and Saul Steinberger,
right,
circling Walt Disney Productions, buying up large blocks of stock and threatening a hostile takeover. And Ron, to be blunt, was looking for a way to appease Disney's already very, very nervous board of directors. So Miller's idea was, I'll go talk to George Lucas, who, again, company already had a working relationship because of those Star Wars Storytel albums. He said, I'll pitch him on the idea of doing Star Wars attractions for the Disney parks, maybe even see if he'd be willing to make a movie for a studio. If I can bring that to the board, that should make them and Wall Street happy. So George, he makes the drive up to Napa, and over a lunch of chicken salad sandwiches, which, by the way, Diane Disney Miller made herself. Ron pitches his idea to Lucas. And to hear Ron talk, George seemed amenable to the idea. He would, of course, need to go back to up to Skywalker Ranch and talk to the rest of the team at Lucasfilm. But this was an idea that George seemed willing to discuss, explore further. But what Ron Miller didn't know was by the time he had set up this meeting at Silverado with George Lucas, it was already too late. Roy Disney and Stanley Gold were already planning on ousting him as Disney's chairman and CEO. More to the point, these two were already talking with members of Disney's board of directors about who the company should recruit to replace Ron. And very high on Roy and Stanley's list was one Michael D. Eisner. Now, Brian, quick aside here. A lot of people today forget why Michael Eisner was available to become the new head of the Mouse House in the fall of 84. And that was because when Michael Eisner's boss, Barry Diller, who'd been the chairman and CEO of Paramount Pictures Corporation from 1974 to 1984, left in the fall of that year to become the new chairman and CEO of 20th Century Fox. This happened in October of 84. Paramount's board of directors opted not to promote Michael Eisner, naming him Paramount's new chairman and CEO. And Eisner knew that if he stayed at Paramount after that,
right,
he would forever be seen by those in Hollywood as damaged goods, as the guy that Paramount's board of directors didn't think of as worthy to be named as the new chairman and CEO. And so to Eisner's way of thinking, he had no choice. He had to leave Paramount. He had to exit that studio and land the job at another studio, ideally someplace that would then appoint him chairman and CEO, so he wouldn't lose face among his peers. Now, another interesting little bend in this story, Brian, it's late September of 84, and the deal is done. Michael Eisner and Frank Wells have just convinced Disney's board of directors that they should be the new team to run the Mouse House. And so now the doors close, and Eisner and Wells are in private, and they now discuss, okay, who's going to do what now that we're running Disney? And Frank Wells, who had been the vice chairman of Warner Brothers before leaving the entertainment conglomerate in 1982, so he could then go off and achieve his life's dream, which was to climb the 7 highest summits on the planet. And by the way, if you want to read a great book about the 7 summits, amazing book, check it out. Wells just assumed, okay, I was vice chairman at Warner, so I'll be Disney's chairman and CEO. And while Eisner, who previously been president of Paramount Pictures under Barry Diller, would just assume that role again when these two took over at Disney. And Michael was adamant that he had to be Disney's new chairman and CEO, or the deal was off. And Frank Wells, God love him, he was a pragmatist. He reasoned, look, job titles, especially in Hollywood, matter little, especially behind the scenes at places like Disney. I mean, which is why Frank said, okay, fine, that's what you need. Michael, you get to be Disney's new chairman and CEO, while I will be the company's new president and chief operating officer. And by the way, one of the ways that Eisner actually got this job at Disney, and this is something that George perhaps neglected to tell Ron Miller while they're dining out on the patio, eating those chicken salad sandwiches that Diane had prepped for them. But in the spring of 84, when Michael got wind that Barry Diller, the 20th Century Fox, was feeling him out about, well, do you want to be our chairman and CEO? And just sort of started counting noses at the board of directors and realized, I don't have a lot of people here in my corner. He started to make contingency plans. And in the same window of time, word on the street that Ron Miller was not long for this world over at Disney, that studio would be looking for a new chairman and CEO soon. So that's when Eisner turned to Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, who, remember from our New York Times article, they had all worked together on Raiders and Temple of Doom. He asked Spielberg and Lucas to reach out to individual members of Disney's board of directors and effectively say, look, we work with Michael when he was over at Paramount. More to the point, he was the guy who was willing to make the Raiders of the Lost Ark deal with us when no one else in Hollywood, including Ron Miller at Disney, would. And if Michael would end up over at Disney, well, we would then be inclined to come make movies at your studio. So behind the scenes, Spielberg and Lucas were already shilling for Eisner. And I have to wonder how long after their lunch at Silverado Vineyard did Miller learn about this? All right. Anyway, back to February of 85, some 3 months after this, May of that same year, 1985, Eisner reveals that Disney would be building a third theme park down in Florida, One that would be a combination production facility studio tour that would celebrate the golden age of Hollywood. Now, in the early days of this project, the studio tour for Florida was supposed to have two stunt shows. One that would have shined a spotlight on the silent era of Hollywood history.
Oh, cool.
With a focus on slapstick comedy. And I've seen art of at least one version of the show that was supposed to actually be set at Mack Sennett Studios.
And, oh, wow.
And would have featured an appearance by the Keystone Cops, where the second stunt show. Okay, now... again, you got to remember, July of 1985, Disney announces that they just cut a deal with MGM UA, which will allow them to use films from their library, themes, and excerpts from that film library as part of this new project for Florida. And one of the ideas that the Imagineers explored as part of this phase of the project was a Tarzan-themed stunt show. And again, I don't need to tell Brian this because he's old and he went to watch movies at repertory theaters. But people forget these days that between 1932 and 1942, MGM made six Tarzan movies that starred five-time Olympic gold medalist Johnny Weissmuller. And what's especially funny about this Tarzan stunt show was that it was supposed to be Disney's equivalent of Universal's Animals Actor show, so that in between Tarzan Jane and Boy making their entrance in the show by swinging in on vines, guests attending would have gotten to see chimpanzees and elephants and alligators and lions and
tigers. Oh my!
the other thing worth noting is during this same period of time, the Imagineers are also toying with the idea of building a fourth theme park in Florida, one that would be built around animals. So this Animal Actors-inspired show actually got pulled off of the studio tour pile and then got reassigned to Park 4 for Florida, which again was supposed to celebrate animals, which left this second stunt show that was in the works for the studio tour without a hook. But the Imagineers, who were already working with George Lucas on Captain EO and Star Tours at this time, well, they thought, you know, Indiana Jones might be a very smart IP to build a stunt show around. And I mean, after all, Lucas had just announced around the same time that Eisner became Disney's new CEO and chairman that he was working on a third Indiana Jones movie. We're talking September of 84. And at this time, Brian, the title of that movie was Indiana Jones and the Monkey King.
Oh.
And it would have started off with Indy battling a ghost in a haunted castle in Scotland. This was now going to be the now traditional opening action scene that we can always find in an indie movie. And then the main plot of the film would have been Dr. Jones traveling to Africa in search of the Fountain of Youth. That movie, of course, never happened. But we got the Indiana Jones Epic Stunt Spectacular at Disney MGM, opening in the late summer of 89, the very same summer that Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade debuted in theaters. And then Disneyland in March of 1995 got the Indiana Jones Adventure. And how we got those two indie-based attractions, we will discuss on the next Looking at Lucasfilm.
Oh, no!
Which we'll post in 2 weeks' time. But in the meantime, Brian.
Well, is this like Shakespeare's Lost Play or something? There's a lot of backstabbing going on. There's a lot of A2 Brute.
Well, that is the industry and remains the industry. I mean, just this past week with what was going on over at Paramount with Skydance and Edgar Braffman, that got a little interesting as well. So, all right. In the meantime, until we get to the next part of this Indy and the Disney theme park story, where can the nice folks find you, Brian, on social media?
Well, they can find me at Instagram at btgaughan. I'm going to, the things we talked about, I'm going to put some pictures up there about from D23 and things like that. So that's where can we find you?
Let's see. I am on X, the site formerly known as Twitter, and over on Instagram as Jim Hill Media, and over on Facebook as Jim Hill Media News. Beyond that, I want to remind you, we have a couple of other podcasts here we'd love you folks to take a look at or lend an ear to. We have, of course, Disney Dish that I do with Len Testa. Likewise, we have Fine Tuning, which I do with Drew Taylor. And Drew, by the way, has his wonderful official Mission Impossible podcast, Light the Fuse, that he does with Charles Hood. Highly recommend that you check that out. Likewise, we have our Epic Universal podcast I do with Eric Hersey.
Yeah.
He edits and produces a lot of the shows here, does a great
job.
And
he was also, he and his wife were also with us at D23.
That they were. And in fact, thank you for mentioning Lauren, Lauren Hersey, who I do the I Want That To, our merch podcast. In fact, we just did a show about all of the merch you could see at the D23 Expo. And let's see. Oh, also want to be sure and mention we are hosting a podcast that Noah and Shelley Valladolid do called Manufacturing the Magic, which looks back at the history of themed entertainment. Oh, there'll be a brand new episode of that dropping this weekend. And also want to remind you about our Patreon effort, Disney Unpacked. This is Len and my first ever video series. We're producing it in collaboration with Jim Shull, who spent 30 plus years at Disney Imagineering, dreaming up some of your favorite attractions of the park. And episode 2 of season 2 will be debuting this weekend. It'll take a look back at Dumbo the Flying Elephant, which is a very simple seeming attraction that has a kind of convoluted history. Show should be worth a listen. Also, we'll have a show dropping shortly about the storybook Land canal boat ride at Disneyland Paris, which, by the way, actually reopened today, Friday, August 30th, the day this podcast goes live. So kind of newsworthy when we finally get it up there. And let's see, beyond that, if you folks could do Brian and I a favor, if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and recommend our show, that helps with ratings and helps other people find the show.
Also comments. If you have any comments of what we say or don't say, please go to the Patreon and leave some comments there.
Got it. And I guess for now, that's going to do it for this week's show. So thanks for listening. And Mr. Gaughan and I will be back soon.